Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and Kokomo, Indiana. She earned an undergraduate and a master's degree from Michigan State University while winning the 1983 NCAA 400-meter hurdles championship. Sports Illustrated magazine selected her as one of its 1987 Sports Persons of the Year for her community involvement. Today, she serves as a member of the Lansing City Council. Her name? Judy Brown Clark. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Judy Brown Clark, who in 1987 was Sports Illustrated Sports Person of the Year. That is tall cotton, Judy. Welcome. What an honor to have you.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you, Jack.
Can we start by talking about your childhood?
Yes.
And your mom and your dad.
So growing up, I come from a family that is extremely athletic looking. I have a brother 6'10", 6'8", my mother's 5'10", my father 6'2". I have a sister that's more common height, that's 5'2", but we were very academic, and so I didn't grow up with sports necessarily. We didn't watch it on television, so that really was kind of my academic background. And then sports was something that one of my brothers, or my two brothers and I excelled in. And so I always had this balance between being extremely inquisitive and also being extremely physical.
What's the biggest thing you learned from mom, and what's the biggest thing you learned from dad?
I think the biggest thing I learned from my parents, I mean, my mother grew up in Mississippi. There was a dirt floor. There was no electricity, no running water. And so I learned tenacity, and I learned about being a strong woman and absolutely being able to persevere. My father came from Maryland, and my father was an engineer, so I learned real analytical thoughtfulness, really being strategic. And so I think that real analytical, with my mother's background of being very creative and tenacity, I think it all came together and kind of culminated in who I am.
Your dream was to become a volleyball star.
Absolutely.
What happened?
Well, you know, I came during Title IX. And that was about the time I entered middle school. And so they were bringing into women's sports, and one of the sports was basketball and volleyball. So those are my two first real introductions of sport. And volleyball, I just loved. I loved the team. I loved the power. I loved the strategy, the physicality. I just loved it. And when we moved from Indiana up to Michigan, there was a difference shift in when seasons were occurring. And then, so I didn't play volleyball my senior year of high school when I moved to Michigan. And then there wasn't a volleyball team at Michigan State when I started. So I pursued track.
You go to Michigan State.
Yes.
God brings angels to each of us throughout our life.
Absolutely.
And one day he brought you an angel by the name of Coach Jim Bibbs.
Absolutely. And actually, I met his daughter, Tanya. Tanya was at the high school. So we moved my senior year of high school, and I didn't know anybody at the school. We moved in the spring. And so I happened to go to school with some of the new neighbor kids, and I met Tanya. And Tanya, her father was Jim Bibbs. And she's like, you know, my father's a track coach, and you ought to meet him. And at that point in time, I was talking basketball, because I came out of Indiana. Indiana's big-time basketball, so that's all I talked about was basketball. And then I said, well, you know, I run track, too. And so she introduced me to her dad, and, you know, from Coach Bibbs on, it was just, you know, that's how I met one of my angels.
In 1951, Jim Bibbs tied Jesse Owens' world record in the 60-yard dash. He was the first African-American coach at Michigan State. He was the first Big Ten track coach in 75. He coached 26 All-Americans and 52 Big Ten champions.
How about that?
But only one, Judy Brown Clark.
Absolutely.
Speaking of which, 1983.
Yes.
You're in the finals of the NCAA championship.
Right.
In the 400-meter hurdles. What happened?
Oh, my God. I was scared to death. You know, I was coming out of Michigan. And in Michigan, I mean, our weather doesn't really break until really like the first week of May. So all the southern schools had been running these phenomenal times for probably about 2 months. And here we came down from Michigan and we all looked pale and we hadn't had much sun. We're vitamin D deprived. And so I knew about these times. And for me, it was like, okay, I'm kind of point in time. So it's like, okay, what do I need to do right now to get to the next level? So what do I need to do from the prelims to the semis to the final? And in the finals, it was very hot. It was very hot. I mean, in Michigan, it was probably starting to be in the 70s. Right there, it was like, it was 90, and it was extremely humid. So it was hot, humid, and nothing that we had been training in. And it was just a matter of, you know what, I know what I need to do. So if I do what I need to do, then I know that I can be in the top three. And it just so happened that I did what I was supposed to do. And I was right there. And all I had to do was maintain across the finish line. And it was like our new plateau. It really helped me define who I was as an athlete and really my first glimpse of being world class.
You won 12 Big Ten titles, and you won 2 gold medals in the Pan Am Games.
3 gold medals in the Pan Am Games. Thank you, Jack.
Well, 2 or 3. Okay. What was it like in the Pan Am Games?
The Pan Am Games, it was really interesting because we went down and we ran in Caracas, Venezuela, but it was during the time there was a lot of unrest with the U.S. in Grenada. And so when we were down there, there was a tremendous amount of military protection for us. So actually when we would go outside of where they had the athletes staying, we couldn't wear our USA anything that signified what country you were from. And of course, being African American, I fit in real easy. Not everybody did. And it was, so it was really interesting. And one thing that was just kind of a caveat story is we were on a bus going downtown because we were going to do some shopping. And there was like, we had 2 military guys. They had their M78s on their arms. They're looking, you know, keeping us safe. And one, we kept thinking, oh my gosh, he looks so young. And we didn't speak Spanish. And it was more kind of a broken Spanish, Portuguese kind of a dialect that we didn't know. So we kind of figured out, you know, we're like, well, how old is the guard in the back? He was 14. He was 14, and the one in the front was 19. And those are our armed guards, 19 and 14.
We're talking to Judy Brown Clark. When we come back, we'll ask her about the 84 Summer Olympics in Los Angeles. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasul. We're talking to Judy Brown Clark, who has spent her entire life focused on the welfare of others.
Absolutely.
Judy, summer 84, you go to L.A.
Yes.
You're in the finals.
How about that?
The 400-meter hurdles.
Yeah.
Tell us what happened.
It's interesting. I can remember it like it happened this morning. I remember getting in the blocks, and this one thing that was really extraordinary is when we walked into the stadium. They kind of have you in a chute before your race. So you're pretty much going out on schedule. So right before our race, we're all kind of just sitting there waiting for the previous race to finish. So we walk out, and at that point in time, I was the only American, and so the crowd erupted. Because, you know, here it was, you know, the Olympics, and every time there was a U.S. competitor, they supported us to the maximum. And so I understand what it felt like to be the quarterback of a Super Bowl, because it was deafening, and literally the hairs on your arms. Of course, I shaved my arms, so the hairs on my head went up because it was just electric. I get in the blocks, and because I'm the only American, and everybody has a brochure. They know my name. So a lot of people are yelling my name, and so it's really hard to hear the starter because I'm in lane 8, he's in lane 1, and literally he's about 100 meters away from me. And we have blocks in the back of our blocks, but I really can't hear him. So I thought what I'll do is I'll just react when I hear the crowd react. So it's like, you know, runners take your marks, set, and the gun. So I hear the crowd react, and then I react. And I think, and fortunately, that was a false start. So I'm thinking, okay, I didn't react fast enough. So then, you know, we go off another time. Again, I still can't hear, but I go off the reaction off the crowd, and I go. So I'm in lane 8, which means I'm in front of everybody. I get out, and I'm thinking, huh, I'm doing great. I don't see anybody yet. Go over the first hurdle. Still doing okay. Second hurdle, I see Nuala Mutuwakil. Then between the second and third hurdle, I see two other people. But I know their strategies. They go out fast. That's not unusual. Between the third and fourth hurdle, I see the fourth, fifth. And between the fifth and sixth, or fourth and fifth hurdle, I see the sixth, seventh. There's only 8 in the race, which means that I am now 8th. And so then, like most mature people, I started thinking of all the ways I was going to spin why I hadn't run well. And I came up with all these different excuses. And I mean, this is a millisecond conversation I'm having with myself. And literally, I kind of had just this secondary conversation of our, you know, really reasoning with, you know, our, I won't say what I said, but I do have an interesting look on my face on the fifth hurdle of kind of going through the inventory of all I've done and given up and the training and the incredible amount of tenacity to get here. And then literally picked off the seventh person, sixth person, fifth, fourth, third, second. And we're coming right to the 10th hurdle, or coming off the 10th hurdle. And Nuala was on the inside, and she's shorter. So I didn't see her until I came off the 10th hurdle, and I realized that she was still ahead. And I tried to close in on her, and I wasn't able to. And she didn't beat me before the Olympics. She hadn't beaten me after the Olympics, but she beat me that day.
And she was from Morocco.
She was from Morocco.
Judy.
Yes.
Do you ever regret that you came in second and didn't win an Olympic gold medal?
Well, you know, immediately, yes, I'm a competitor. I wanted to win, you know, but I've always been in a person that's always said, you know, everything happens for a reason. And Nuala was a good friend of mine. And, you know, as soon as we finished the race, I immediately went to her, embraced her and congratulated her and so on. Nuala has used that gold medal to really become an incredible change agent for Muslim women, not just a country, but really for Muslim women, on breaking down barriers for education and athletics and just literacy and having a voice. If I had won, those things would not have happened. And I don't know if she would have had that platform with the silver. But with the gold, I can't imagine that gold medal going any further than it has, with her being the recipient. So,
well, let me say this, Judy Brunkluck.
Yes.
With your silver,
yes,
you were the world's best hurdler.
Yes.
And then you devoted your life to helping other people overcome their life's hurdles.
Absolutely.
And you've continued to do it.
Yes.
Talk to us about track and field. If there's a young athlete tonight listening, why should they go and focus on track and field?
The beauty of track and field, I think, is every skill you need in life happens on the track. There's certain things you're going to do that are individual. There's certain things you're going to do that are team. And there's times in life you're individuals. There's times in life that you're at a team. Your ability to number one, follow direction and be coachable. Number two, to goal set. Number three, to be a student of the sport. You cannot excel as an elite athlete and not become a student of the sport. You have to be as gifted, fast twitch from the neck down as you are from the neck up. Your ability to read the situation, taking all the variables as to what's going on and looking at your opponent and whether your opponent is a challenge. What do I need to know and how do I react to it real time with the situation that's going on? Because that's what defense is. Offense is knowing all the possible scenarios. How do I play this to my advantage so that whatever I hope the outcome will be, that I'm actually to maximize it? So track and field is the epitome of the, if you want to call a silver bullet, of being successful in life.
1985.
Yeah.
You leave East Lansing and you go to a state called Oregon and go to work for this new company called Nike.
Yeah, and you can't say Oregon because then you sound like you're not a native. You have to say Oregon.
Oregon.
Exactly. Yeah, actually, I moved, I graduated in 83, and I actually moved to Oregon in 83. So I was actually competing or training out there for the Olympics. And yeah, working for Nike, it's, you know, I tell you, if there's any regrets I have, and I have a life of no regrets, but here is one. I would have bought far more stock in Nike had I known, and I would have kept a lot of those retro Jordans, which are now five times the amount I would have paid for. But yeah, working, I love my time in Oregon. It's very unusual because Oregon is not necessarily the kind of state that somebody on the outside can come in and really feel embraced. But I think my sports background really kind of negated a lot of what it would take for somebody to feel like they're at home. And I was 40 minutes from, you know, it was like an hour from the ocean and 40 minutes from the base of the Three Sister Mountains. And so I had the ability to go up in the mountains and ski and then go to the ocean and bottom fish. And life was good.
Tell us a little bit about Phil Knight.
Phil Knight. Oh, what a mastermind. What an incredible mastermind. And I mean, you talk about sport imitating life, you know, being a distance runner and knowing what it takes to really stay focused on what your end result is, but knowing that there's a tremendous amount of effort that it's going to take to get across the line. And that's what Phil did, moving Nike forward, really having a vision when most of the top athletic clothing and footwear were international. They were not other than at that point in time. I'm trying to think of that's a while ago. I'm trying to think of who else really was getting their foot in the door at that time. But Puma, Adidas. I mean, those were just the incredible giants. And to think that, you know, to think like a giant when you're not there, that's foresight.
We're talking to Judy Brown Clark. When we come back, we'll ask about how it was she started to volunteer with infants at nurseries and how it changed her life and the life of an awful lot of people. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula, and we're with Judy Brown Clark, who in the 80s was named the Female Athlete of the Decade.
Yes.
For Michigan State University. Wow. While you were in Eugene, Oregon,
yes,
you begin to volunteer with infants at nurseries.
Yes.
How and why?
Well, you know, I've always had an incredible internal responsibility, sense of responsibility to give back and reciprocate. And I was training 2 days or three times a day. So in the morning, I do a run that I would do from 10 to 12 and 4 to 6. But I have a lot of energy and I had a lot of time left. And so I was thinking, okay, so now what? I just can't train and not do anything else. So I saw this small little ad in the paper, and it was a church that was opening up this relief nursery from birth to age 5. And I thought, well, what a fantastic opportunity. And I'll go volunteer there, and I'll kind of fit that in between my practices. And it'll give me a chance to give back, and I'll just absolutely enjoy it. And that's how it started.
You've been around a lot of special needs children.
I have.
Through the years. Judy, what have they taught you?
Oh, my goodness. You know, I grew up on a really magical street when I lived in Milwaukee, and that was from birth through fifth grade. And there, down the corner, there was a family that took in foster kids. And I didn't know what foster kids were. I just knew that there was a sibling group there, and then all of a sudden they weren't. And then there was a new set of kids, but the same parents were there. And then all of a sudden they weren't. Then a new set would come in. And so I learned literally probably in kindergarten what foster care was. And then we had probably four different families that were doing foster care. And then we had one family that was an adoptive family. And then one of the foster families that did started adopting some of the kids. So it was ingrained in me very early that I always knew I was going to adopt. And I always knew that I would do foster care and that I would work with families around functioning and kids that had less than, because I was one step from less than. And so it's, so for me to start volunteering was just extremely natural. And so literally I would do a 2-hour hard practice. I would literally grab something to eat. I would go to the nursery. So I'd practice from 10 to 12, from 12:15 until 3:45, I would be at the nursery. And then from 4 to 6, I would be back on the track again.
Let's jump till the end of 1987.
Yeah.
And since its inception in 1954, Sports Illustrated, in its last issue, has always presented its Sports Person of the Year.
Yes.
Once it was the 1980 hockey team. Once it was the 2005 or 6 Boston Red Sox team. It was the 2000 women's soccer team. But usually, it's one or two people.
Yes.
And in 1987, it named 8 athletes.
Yes.
You're one of them.
Yes.
It's only had 8 track and field athletes, so honored. And there's only been 2 female track and field athletes, yourself and Mary Decker.
Yes.
How did you find out you became a Sports Person of the Year?
Oh, that was such an honor. Kenny is the, he was, you know, the one that wrote the article. He's the one that nominated me. And he would come sometime to Oregon, you know, just around Sports Illustrated, because we had a lot of track and field there. And so he started hearing stories about me, you know, unbeknownst to me. And what I was doing it because that's just who I am. And but it was admired. And so he actually nominated me, wrote this wonderful nomination for me, and then it was accepted. And I don't know what the pool of athletes were, but my understanding is it was a considerable pool, so it was a phenomenal honor for me.
There's only been 2, 4, 6. There's only been 8 female athletes honored since 1954.
Without a swimsuit.
Billie Jean King, Chris Everett, Mary Decker, Mary Lou Retton, Bonnie Blair, the 1999 women's soccer team, Pat Summitt, and yourself.
How about that?
And it was Kenny Moore that wrote the article.
Yes.
You were honored with 7 others.
Yes.
Bob Bourne, Kip Kenyo, yes. Dale Murphy, Chip Reeves, Patty Sheehan, a golfer.
Yes.
Rory Sparrow, Reggie Williams, yourself. All phenomenal people.
Yes.
If you would, tell us about Kip Kenyo.
Kip is very much that incredible change agent, like I was referring to with Nawala Mutawakil. Kip took the money. When he ran, he took all those dollars back home, and he opened up orphanages, and he created schools, and he created hospitals where there was, you know, definitely areas of no entitlements, and save lives. These kids would not have survived. I'm not just saying that figuratively, or they would have struggled. These kids would not have survived if they hadn't been in the safety of being in these orphanages and under, you know, receiving education, good health care, and actually becoming part of the family. And he is just an incredible saint. And he has continued to reinvest anything that he has been able to win through his athletics or what he represents. And he has just leveraged his celebrity in a way in which I there's very few other athletes that have reached that plateau and in my mind, that level of respect.
When you tell your 3 sons, I was a Sports Person of the Year for Sports Illustrated, what do they say?
Wah, wah. Okay, my kids are like everybody else's kids, and so, you know, I'm just mom to them. And, you know, even if you came in my house, you probably wouldn't see anything sports-related. It's, you know, one thing I always wanted to do with them is I never wanted them to have the pressure of having to fill or fulfill my legacy, is to create their own legacy. And so, you know, rightfully so, you know, they've all made their own mark, And I'm just kind of that secondary quiet coach that's in their ear, just, you know, affirming them and the things that, that they want to do. But like any other, they would probably roll their eyes. They're getting better as they get older.
One night in 2004, Sports Illustrated has their 50th anniversary party.
Yeah.
And they throw a huge gala, the Waldorf Astoria, New York City.
Yes.
Everybody, it's anybody's in sports there.
Right.
What was that night like?
That was like going to the Oscars. It was phenomenal. I mean, it was a who's who of phenomenal legends. And half the time, it's like you couldn't even keep up because people are just walking by and you're like, and they walk by you and you look and you're thinking, I think that was so-and-so. But there was like this incredible respect that it really, you know, the part where we were really wasn't where the public was. We were around other athletes. And so there was this incredible collegial respect. So there wasn't a lot of picture taken. Now, this is before selfies and cell phones, so I'm sure there would have been a lot now. But there really wasn't a whole lot of people taking pictures. There weren't a lot of autographs. It was just a lot of people just walking up and genuinely having conversations and just really feeling like teammates. So you're walking up to people and you're, you know, so-and-so, and you're just talking to them about, you know, their career and maybe what they're doing at that point in time or catching up on them or checking on an injury. And it was just really magical.
Judy Brown-Clark, when you put your head on the pillow that night at the Waldorf.
Yeah.
What did you think about?
Oh my God, I was probably thinking, it's like, you know, about 50 years ago, they wouldn't even let me in this room. So, you know, it was... It was a crescendo moment. I think there's sometimes when, you know, you do things and you never really take the time to really look back and think, you know, job well done. And that was one of those nights, you know, kind of like after the Olympics, that was one of those nights that you really just take a pause in the, you know, the rat race of life and really say, you know, that job well done.
We're talking to Judy Brown-Clark, who today is part of the Lansing City Council.
How about that?
And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything is Possible, and we're talking to Judy Brown-Clark, who has spent her entire life focused on the welfare of others. You don't judge other people.
No.
And there's a saying, there but for the grace of God go I.
Absolutely.
A lot of us judge others.
Yes.
Why don't you?
You know, there's a very thin line between quote unquote us and them. You know, and life is fragile. And there's people that have been doing extremely phenomenal and something happens in their life and it's upside down and they go from a status of comfort to, you know, crisis. And so for me, it's just never been, I've never been in a position or wanting to be in a place where I'm judging anyone other than, you know, judging a situation as to how I can help.
Speaking of judging.
Yes.
You're married to Judge Hugh Clark Jr.
Absolutely.
So in your household, is he a judge?
Yeah, he is. He is. But you know what? I love my husband. You know, he was an attorney for 30 years. And so he knows the law and he's seen justice and injustice. And the beauty of where he is within the judicial system is really in a place in which he can really look at fairness and equity. And so it's really the beauty of a long career. And the pinnacle part is really with that fairness and injustice.
You ever let him wear the robe around the house?
Oh, my God, no.
I quote you now.
But would he want to? Yes.
I was always an advocate for the unhappy.
Yes.
If there's someone this evening who's down and out, unhappy with their life, Judy, what do you say to him or her?
You know, when I think about, you know, one thing I think about unhappiness is that's a lot of self-judging. And in the scheme of life, you know, there's things you can and can't control. And it's very important you know the difference. If you cannot control it, you cannot dedicate energy to it. You cannot. You have to focus on the things that you can control. And then how do you create a plan to move forward, to really deal with those things and to figure out ways in which and strategies. And that's kind of the sport in me is, for me, what's most important is being resilient. And life is too short and I have so much to do. Everyone's valuable. And I think the biggest thing is self-forgiveness. I think most people get in this personal loop of I shoulda, coulda, woulda, and that's not productive.
Judy, it's easy for you to be so positive and happy because you've had this perfect life.
Oh, really? You know what? You know what has been perfect is a strategy that I'm using to get through it. You know, life is full of lessons. And usually when something happens and it doesn't turn out the way I thought it should, it falls in categories. It's okay. Everything has a lesson and everything deserves a meaning. And so when something happens that I don't want to happen, you know, that I didn't anticipate, then I have to look at, okay, so why did it happen? Is it something that I didn't anticipate? Was it something I didn't have control over? Did I underestimate the situation? Did I overestimate the situation? And then it's all about being strategic. Because you know what? When I die, I want to have the stupidest smile on my face. And, you know, I really want to live life with no regrets.
From 92 until 95,
yep.
You were the head woman's track coach at MSU. What did that experience teach you?
You know what I love? I just love developing people, and I love to see people come into their own. The beauty of, you know, being the head coach is to see athletes coming out of their high school career, wide-eyed, you know, and being able to take them to this new level of college savviness and helping them. It's really a rite of passage. That's what college is. And helping them tease out these lessons that they're learning in athletics and translate them with these new academic skills into being, you know, savvy, incredible, and productive citizens. That is just so satisfying for me.
From 95 through 2005, you worked for the Michigan Department of Human Services. Tell us about that decade.
You know, that was interesting. You know, as you know, I think there's things that we feel our passions in our life, and it ebbs and flows as to what percentage of our time we dedicate to it. That was my kind of swing back into working with family. So I worked in Children's Protective Services. I actually was a Protective Services investigator. I worked with foster care and adoption and family, you know, teen pregnant and parenting, homeless and runaway youth, before and after school programming, family functioning, fatherhood initiative. So the 10 years that I worked at Department of Human Services was my way of really reconnecting to really look at, you know, bringing together systems, funding, programming, and individuals that needed assistance, bringing them together to empower them.
2014, new chapter, you decide to run and get into politics.
Yeah.
Lansing City Council.
Yes.
Judy, why?
You know what? I think, you know, there's two kind of people, one that runs out of a burning building and one that runs in. And I've never been a person that if I have a capacity to make a difference, then I'm going to do it. I'm uncomfortable. I'm very comfortable being uncomfortable. Levels of comfort, that is of no consequence to me. And so going into politics, there's some things that I think I can do at the decision-making table, whether it's funding and programming or policies or just being a conduit, that I can do on the political scene that I can't do just as a citizen. And knowing that, then it was just my responsibility to take the step forward.
If there's a couple listening tonight,
yes,
and they say, wow, this woman puts us to shame. We've talked about giving back and helping others.
Yes.
But we always say, we'll do it after we get successful. We'll do it after we retire. We got to make money now. What do you say to those people?
You know, there's a time, life is so fragile. You know, I'm probably within the last 3 weeks, there's probably been about five funerals that have occurred, and it's been an array of ages. You know, we don't know exactly what our duration is during this life. But the bottom life is, I think at the end of the day, it's really about, was the world a little better off because I was here? And it's not always these grand sweeping impacts. It's these little random acts of kindness. Sometimes it's just acknowledging someone who has not been acknowledged for some length of time, all the way up into what you can do. It's all a part of a movement of energy. And when you get in the flow of energy, it reciprocates. Every action has an equal and opposite reaction. So every time you give something, you get it back. And so to me, the more I want out of life is the more I give to life is the more I get out of life. And that reciprocity is, something that just affirms my ability to actually make a difference.
You're the female version of Magic Johnson at MSU.
I love Urban.
What makes Michigan State University so special?
I love Michigan State. It's a large university, yet it has its own culture. There's a sense of pride within the being a Spartan, and people wear that pride very, very strongly. And I think most universities have it. But I can speak as it relates to being a Spartan of being empowered, being embraced. It's a large university, so there's a tremendous amount of opportunity to partner and collaborate and to explore and to grow and to learn and have a cultural diversity and so on. So I think all those things that you can sample, low risk, because there's very few places that you can start to, sample these things and make a mistake where the stakes are high. But at a university, it's low risk because you're in this transition. And I think Michigan State is this wonderful culmination of the ability for a person to really come into their own and transition to an adulthood with some extremely savvy skills.
As our time winds down, what advice would you give to our young listeners?
I think from the young listeners is, to be comfortable, uncomfortable, and to really have this first thirst for knowledge. Get your own information. Use multiple sources and really be curious on how to learn. The way we learn, the technology we use is dynamic. It changes constantly. But you always have to have this incredible thirst for knowledge and to move yourself forward. And the bucket list is you take one thing off, you put another thing on, and just really make a difference in your life. Be able to defend it at the end.
Judy Brown Clark, talk about a person that's done a masterful job of loving others.
Thank you.
Great way to live.
Thank you.
Keep it up.
I will.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spahoma.